Now Joseph was handsome and good-looking. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Lo, having me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her to lie with her or to be with her. But one day when he went up into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to insult us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled and got out of the house." Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home, and she told him the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came into me to insult me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled out of the house." And when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Let us pray silently for a moment. In Christ's name, amen. Krista Blake, age 20, lives in Columbus, Ohio. In the fall of 1990, Krista Blake is planning to enter college. She and her boyfriend are talking about marriage. She is 18 years old. She begins to experience a backache and some loss of energy. She went to her doctor, and she learns that she has AIDS. Listen to her tell the story of how it happened. She was infected with the virus by an older boy, and she said, "He knew that he was infected and did not tell me. Everything in her life has changed. She broke off her relationship with her boyfriend. She has dropped out of college and says a bachelor's degree wouldn't do much for me now. So what is she doing with what's left of her life? She doesn't know how much longer she will have energy and health to do anything much. She's doing the best that she can. She tries to walk a little every day, even if it's a short walk, and maybe over to a nearby park to watch a softball game. She's also trying to do something redemptive with her life. 4 or 5 days a week when she has the energy, she is going around talking to groups of teenagers about AIDS and how to avoid infection. You will note that she's spending her time trying to teach teenagers how to avoid infection. That is the emphasis today on protected sex, on safe sex. And however well-meaning that might be, it is sending a strong message that is morally wrong. The message is that sex is okay before marriage, if you're careful and if you're cautious. And so we are caught in a climate of ambiguity and contradiction. The reality is that there is no safe sex. When you casually go to bed with someone, you are sleeping with their sexual history. And when you pore over the data and the havoc that this behavior has caused and is causing, you're left with a sense of hopelessness. And here are the realities. Reality number one. Many people who know they are infected with the HIV virus that causes AIDS will take no responsibility whatever in protecting a sexual partner. Reality number two. Many young people are living with the illusion that AIDS may be a reality, but it will never happen to them. Reality number three. According to a recent study, only 47% of females and 55% of males use any kind of protection when they have sexual intercourse for the first time. Reality number four. A California professor, Roger Bowman, who teaches a popular course on AIDS at the University of California, has done a great deal of surveying among his students, and he finds that students do not really change their behavior even when they clearly know all of the dangers involved. Reality number five. You can literally die from sleeping around. AIDS is incurable, 100% terminal. If you get it, it's not a question of if you're going to die, it's merely a question of when it's going to happen. A year and a half ago, if someone had mentioned to you the name Magic Johnson, what would have been your first thought? It would have been, I suspect, my, what a great basketball player he is, a veritable artist moving down the court toward the basket, those unbelievable capacities he had to make a strategic pass of the ball to a teammate. What do you think when his name is mentioned today? My first thought is always this. Magic is HIV positive. I wonder when it will begin to take its toll upon him. And he will fade gradually from the commercials and the talk shows on television. In a special article in Sports Illustrated, with candor, Magic, and this is to his credit, said that he was infected because of promiscuous heterosexual behavior. And to quote him, he said, "The problem is that I can't pinpoint the time, the place, or the woman. It's a matter of numbers. Before I was married, I truly lived the bachelor's life. I was never at a loss for female companionship," close quote. It's apparent to me that while knowledge of the dangers of promiscuity is readily available and helpful, it is not a serious deterrent. The facts are, we know better than we are doing. 75% of those who are infected with AIDS worldwide contracted the disease through heterosexual behavior. And while I'm speaking today to everyone in this church, my particular focus today is for the teenagers of this church and their parents, and for the 2,600 young people in this church who are in their 20s. A survey of 17 by 17 magazine reports that 51% of young people between 14 and 21 years old have already had sex. Most people who study these trends say that that is a low figure. It's substantially high. You remember the best-selling book, The Day America Told the Truth? It reported, after an extensive polling involving more than 20,000 persons, that 92% of sexually active people report having had 10 or more lovers with a lifetime average of 17. That's utter madness. And so today, and this is not an easy sermon for me to preach or for you to listen to, but the alternative to preaching it is by our silence to leave the impression that the Church of Jesus Christ somehow or another is saying it's okay, whatever you do. But today I feel compelled to remind one and all that there is another option, and it's spelled N-O. Saying no is the forgotten option. And as the foundation of today's sermon, I would remind you of the dramatic story of Joseph, who is the little Jack Horner of the Old Testament. He was a conceited, coddled, spoiled boy, and when his father gave him the many-colored coat and he reminded all of his brothers how great he really was, they had it up to here with him, and they wanted to kill him, but their older brother talked them out of it, and they sold him into slavery. So young Joseph went from the pinnacle to the pit very quickly. And it's to his credit that when he was sold as a slave into Potiphar's household, that he did the best he could, and very quickly his abilities came to the forefront, and he occupied a very responsible position as chief of staff for Potiphar, who was a mighty power in Pharaoh's household. But then Potiphar went on a trip, and Mrs. Potiphar had a roving eye, and Joseph became a victim of sexual harassment. And he said no. And she was mad, and she told her husband a contrived story. And Joseph is in jail because he said no. Listen. Aside from the morality, the world today would have said to Joseph, what a dummy. Just a little tumble with the boss's wife. Who's to know? What's the harm? Listen, aside from the question of morality, in the face of the fact that it's wrong in this society, in our social climate, it is dangerous. It's deadly. Listen to the plaintive statement of a young victim of AIDS. Do you want to put your life in that other person's hands? Is that boy or girl worth dying for? I doubt it. Every one of my dreams are shattered, blown away. So today, I plead with you, and I warn you, please, in the name of God, consider saying no to sex before marriage. That is the forgotten option. Have you ever considered why Joseph said no? He was young, virile, good-looking. The boss's wife obviously was available and she wanted him. The husband was away from home. Have you ever thought about why he said no? I think he said no for four reasons, and here they are. He said no because he was loyal to those who believed in him. Potiphar trusted young Joseph. Why else would he give Joseph such vast responsibility over all that he owned? Potiphar placed him in a position of high trust. And do you remember what Joseph said to Mrs. Potiphar when she propositioned him? My master trusts me with everything in the entire household. No one has more authority here than I have. A trust requires loyalty and responsibility of being worthy of that trust. It's not easy to be loyal when all of your peers are saying, and some of your closest friends are saying, loosen up a bit. Everybody's doing it. But down inside, you're not living with everybody. You're living with you. And at the end of the day, you've got to be able to live with who you are and what you are becoming. It is not easy to be loyal when the world around you is saying, don't be so old-fashioned. Don't be a fuddy-duddy. I can tell you now, I've lived for more than five decades. That sounds a lot younger to me than 57. And during that time, I have seen the face and the fact of the betrayal of self. I have stood in Christ's name by the beds of many who were facing life's final examination. I have heard none of them say, I'm glad, preacher, I sold some wild oats when I was young. To the contrary, I have seen the face of agony as they try to sort out and put to rest episodes of wrongdoing that reach out and disturb them from across a lifetime, trying to find a sense of peace before God. You can spend a lifetime of inner agony trying to put to rest the indiscretion of one evening. Be loyal. One morning, a first grade teacher walked into her classroom, and there was little Johnny standing in front of the class with his tummy stuck way out. That seemed a little strange to his teacher, so she said, "Johnny, why are you standing there with your tummy stuck way out?" He seemed surprised. He said, "Well, early this morning I had a tummy ache and went to the school nurse, and she said, 'Johnny, just stick it out until noon and you'll be okay.'" Sticking it out is what loyalty requires. Standing firm to the promises we've made to others and to God. Why did Joseph say no? Well, he said no because he was loyal to Potiphar and to the trust that had been given him. And secondly, because he respected the commitment of marriage between Mr. and Mrs. Potiphar. He was one willing to cross the limits of loyalty and fidelity. Potiphar was a busy man. Perhaps he had even neglected his wife. An affair is often a symptom of neglect. Potiphar's neglect may have led to loneliness. And there was both temptation and opportunity operative in that household when he was away. It's obvious that Joseph had a great deal of respect for marriage and the commitment that marriage requires. So he said no. He said no, thirdly, because he had respect for himself. You almost miss it in the record of this dramatic episode in his life. When Joseph was thrown in prison, the record states that the Lord was with Joseph there and was kind to him by granting him favor with the chief jailer. He had respect for himself and for his faith. He preserved his good name. He could live with himself even in jail. When the Civil War was over, Robert E. Lee returned to Virginia. He was offered the presidency of an insurance company. He was broke and unemployed, and the salary, as I remember it, was $10,000 a year, which was a lot back then. And Lee acknowledged to those who approached him and offered him the job that he had very little to offer their company. He had no knowledge or no experience of what he was being asked to do, and he wanted to know what they expected of him, and they said, "We don't expect anything of you. Absolutely nothing." And then this explanation was given: "We just want to use the name Robert E. Lee." And Lee said, "My name is not for sale." He lived and died as Joseph did, with his self-respect intact. He was able to say no, Joseph was, because he was loyal. He respected marriage. He respected himself. And then fourthly, he was able to say no because he was loyal to God. He said to Potiphar's wife, "How can I do this wicked thing? It would be a great sin against God." He had a higher loyalty, higher than his loyalty to his master Potiphar, higher than his loyalty to himself, was his loyalty to God. So do you. So do I. You know, there is madness abroad. Did you read anything about the quote spur posse that was much in the news of late? And I tell you, the television networks ought to be ashamed of themselves for putting these young men on the TV talk shows and riding them around Manhattan in limousines. My, the spur posse thing, the entire city of Lakewood, California ought to be permanently in a state of blushing. And all of the things that are being said in that community, some of the parents of these young men are saying, "Well, boys will be boys." And these boys are going around keeping score on how many girls they make love with. One of them had 60 points. They have turned something that God gave us that was sacred into something that is trivial. It's madness. And what is the most disturbing element of them all is the denial of so many parents. All of the surveys show that parents do not talk meaningfully with their children about proper behavior with the opposite sex. And we are going to create, and it will be ready this fall, a comprehensive program of sex education in this church involving teenagers, their parents, young 20s, anybody who wants to attend it. It's going to be directed by the family ministries of this congregation in conjunction with the counseling capabilities of the Samaritan Center. And we are going to try to raise the consciousness of the members and the parents and the families of this church as to our responsibility in this area. Where do you think your children are going to get the appropriate value content for the making of decisions if you do not develop their moral fiber in the home and in the church? Some time ago, the Wall Street Journal had a long and thoughty article on the forgotten option. It was called the Chastity Revolution. And the Wall Street Journal advanced what for our society is a novel idea. There are, and I'm quoting, some things we do not do because they are wrong. They are wrong because they are against God. And the article highlighted such revolutionary things as this. Chastity means saving sex for marriage. It's an old message that needs a new hearing in the wake of Magic Johnson and others. And it's an old message that needs a new hearing when you have so many of the people that are prominent in the media living a lifestyle that is morally reprehensible. An Illinois law now requires public schools to tell students in sex education that abstaining until marriage is, quote, the expected norm. That's progress. In Spokane, Washington, teenage promotes male and female virginity until marriage and urges those who've already had sex to now refrain until they are married. Chicago's Southwest Parents Committee teaches 6th to 8th graders that, quote, waiting until marriage to have sex is possible, normal, and very healthy, close quote. Abstinence advocates are concerned that the safe sex message gives the wrong idea. And the difficulty of advocating this position is that we live in a society that is permeated by sexual imagery. A typical American adolescent views annually 14,000 instances of sexual material in one TV season alone. One message comes across loud and clear. If you aren't active, you aren't with it. The sexual revolution has degenerated into sexual anarchy, and we are paying the price for it. More than anything else, we need to popularize the notion that it's okay to say no to sex. Harvard's Poussant believes that such a message will be a relief to some young people. A lot of them have sex out of peer pressure. This gives them a reason to say no. There is no safe sex. Considering that only 45% of the sexually active high school students use any kind of protection, and 1 million Americans are thought to be infected with the AIDS virus, our kids are flirting with death. And I hope what I'm fixing to say now is not true. I hope and pray it's not true. But some of these beautiful kids of ours that walk these halls and are here today and are seated in that balcony listening attentively to me as they do every Sunday, God bless them. Some of these beautiful kids, if we are not careful, we are going to gather here for their funerals. And I will be called upon as their pastor to speak a redeeming word. We need to teach our kids to say no. And we need to model that in our own behavior. Now, I've now advanced four reasons why Joseph said no. But I want to ask now for you and me the essential question. How do you say no? And how does I say no? Temptation is as old as humankind. You are tempted. I am tempted. Jesus himself was tempted. We gloss so much of what is happening today to the times. There's so much stress. The pace of life is hectic. The pressure of the bottom line is relentless. But face it, friends, temptations have been around for a long, 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 long time. And we rationalize, and we hear only what we want to hear. But we need to face up to the realities before us. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, in his classic book, The Prince, The Little Prince, put it this way. It is only with the heart that we can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. The only thing that will get us through is to have stout inner convictions that rise out of the foundation of a quality inner life rooted in faith. Sometimes you feel intuitively that something doesn't fit. It's not right. What do I do when I'm tempted? And I don't live 48 miles from any known sin. I'm tempted just as you are. What do I do? Well, I try to apply the four-way test, and I'll give it to you quickly. First is the test of common sense. The test of common sense. The very thing you may be tempted to do could be the dumbest thing you ever thought of. Use your common sense. There's a young man in this church that was out one night with an unruly crowd right up the street in Buckhead. They were drinking and they decided that they were going to walk down the street and start a fight. This young man was with his friends, and when they looked at him and said, "Hurry up and finish that and let's go start a fight," he said, "I'm not going. I'm not going. I'm not going to be involved. It's a dumb thing to do, and we could get in trouble." It broke the mood of the moment. He used his common sense, and guess what? His friends dropped him like a hot potato. No matter. When tempted, use your common sense, and then use what a close friend of mine tells me. Use the smell test. Does it smell right? How would it play if it were written on the front page of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution? Would you like your family to know it? Your parents, your friends at church, your grandchildren, and your preacher? Use the smell test. And thirdly, the test of your best. Will this represent the best of who you are? If it doesn't, don't do it. Can you live with yourself if you do it? And fourthly, would Jesus Christ say, "Well done, Frank, if you did it"? Will it measure up to the Spirit of Christ? Will it pass muster on the teachings of Christ? Will it in human relationships honor the golden rule? When tempted, common sense, the smell test, the test of your best, and would it honor Jesus Christ? When you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king or queen for a day, just go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that person has to say. For it isn't your father or your mother or your wife whose judgment upon you must pass. It's the person whose verdict counts most in your life is the person staring back from the looking glass. Some people might think you're a straight-shooting person and call you a wonderful guy or gal. But the person in the glass may say you're only a bum if you can't look them straight in the eye. It's the person in the glass that you must please. Never mind all the rest. For that person with you clear to the is with you clear to the end, and you've passed your most dangerous test. If the guy or the gal in the glass is your friend, you may fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on your back as you pass by, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the person in that glass. And it's bigger than even that. Harry Emerson Fosdick captured it in a great hymn. O Lord and Master of us all, whate'er our name or sign, we own thy way, we hear thy call. We test our lives by thine. We give thanks, O Lord, for these moments together. We ask your blessings upon us now. As we